This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it, but very few of us know exactly how they do it. And that's where my guest, Olivia Judson, enters the picture. She's a biologist and journalist who specializes in the evolutionary biology of sex. Her articles have appeared in Science, Nature, The Economist, and other publications. Judson says that we don't know the most basic things about this most basic of functions. Think about it. Humans would say sex is copulation, but frogs and most fish would say it's the squirting of eggs and sperm during spawning. Then again, scorpions might tell you that sex is packets of sperm deposited on the ground for the female to sit on so they'll explode in her reproductive tract. To address the varied and colorful conflicts that arise in the process of reproducing, Olivia Judson has invented a helpful persona in her guidebook to the evolutionary biology of sex. Dr. Tatiana's sex advice to all creation.
Dear Dr. Tatiana, I'm a queen bee, and I'm worried. All my lovers leave their genitals inside me and then drop dead. Is this normal? Perplexed in Cloverhill. For your lovers, this is the way the world ends, with a bang, not a whimper. When a male honeybee reaches his climax, he explodes, his genitals ripped from his body with a loud snap. I can see why you find it unnerving. Why does it happen? Alas, Your Majesty, your lovers explode on purpose. By leaving their genitals inside you, they block you up. In doing so, each male hopes you will not be able to mate with another. In other words, his mutilated member is intended as the honeybee version of a chastity belt.
Olivia Judson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The queen bee's question really plunges one into the battle between the sexes right at the beginning of the book. Well, it's really a battle on all fronts.
Yes.
Every man and woman for himself and herself. Do you see this in the likely evolutionary scenario of the honeybee?
I do. I think that the honeybee is a very good example of the sorts of conflicts that arise. The problem is that if a female benefits from mating with more than one male, and in most species we now know, although this is a recent finding, in most species it seems clear that females do benefit a great deal from mating with more than one male. This is a real problem for each of her lovers, because from her point of view, she benefits, she has more and healthier offspring. From his point of view, it's a catastrophe, because her mating with other males means that fewer of her offspring will be his. And in the case of the honeybee, it's particularly dramatic because each male has, in the first place, a very small chance of mating at all. The fate of most male honeybees is to die virgins. And so those that do have, in fact, nothing to lose by exploding. And the advantage of exploding is that by leaving his member behind, he may be able to prevent the female from mating again. But it's a problem for other males, because obviously they would like to mate as well. And so you would expect to see that the queen does not want to be prevented from mating again, and that other males do not want to be prevented from mating with her. And so, sure enough, the queen is able to clean herself up if she is inclined to. And the males also have now evolved a structure on the tips of their phallus, which allows them to remove the detritus from a previous lover.
Like a scoop?
Yeah, kind of. It's very common. A lot of males have this feature.
This gets us into promiscuity among males and females in the animal world. And the cliche of human sexuality is that men are promiscuous and women are chaste. How does that play itself out in other species?
I think that's complete nonsense. It used to be thought that that was generally true throughout the animal kingdom, that males were philanderers and females were very virtuous and would resist mating and would never, you know, after they'd mated once, particularly in species that store sperm, they would have enough sperm for their whole lives, and that would be that. They would not be interested in sex anymore. Females are, in general, however, much, much more promiscuous than they need to be if fertilizing their eggs were the only aim. And that discovery was not made until the 1980s. And then it wasn't even realized. So it was realized in the 1980s that females were more promiscuous than people thought. And then it was realized that, in fact, promiscuous females benefit from promiscuity, benefit from their behavior. In other words, promiscuous females tend to have more and healthier offspring in pretty much every species that I could find data for.
And what's the correlation there? Why would that be so?
Well, There's a large industry now in the last, even 3 or 4 years. This has been something that scientists have started looking at because it's been impossible to avoid anymore this horrible truth that females gain from promiscuity. And I think that there are a number of possible reasons. There is no single explanation. But there are all sorts of possible reasons, varying from the idea that females are trying to get higher quality mates, that they meet one guy and they have sex with him just to make sure their eggs are fertilized, and then they meet a better guy so they have sex with him too. That's one idea. Another idea is that having sex with different males allows them to have more help. There are some very obvious cases where this is true. In the bronze-winged jacana, which is a water bird that lives in India, the females run a harem where each female will try to have several males to herself. And the males do all of the work of sitting on eggs and feeding the chicks and building the nests, and the female just sort of, you know, has a grand old time.
In other species, do females only mate with males bearing gifts, like the proverbial box of chocolates?
It's very common. It's not always necessary, but it's very common, particularly in insects, and it can be extraordinarily expensive for the male. To produce gifts. Males in most species obviously can't just go down the street and buy whatever they think is appropriate. They have evolved to produce gifts of various sorts. For example, they may hunt and bring the female something that they've caught to show that they're good at hunting, or just, you know, to please her. They may secrete something to give her. For example, in many butterflies, the male will secrete a large gift. And these can be very expensive. In the green-veined butterfly, it's 15% of his body weight. And basically, a male can only do this once. Each subsequent gift will be smaller. And females prefer males with large gifts. So in this species, virgins have an advantage.
Olivia Judson's book is Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation. We'll hear more after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back now with evolutionary biologist and journalist Olivia Judson. One of my favorite letters is from an iguana in your book, and it goes like this. Dear Dr. Tatiana, I'm a marine iguana, and I'm appalled by the behavior of young iguanas today. I keep encountering groups of youths masturbating at me. It's revolting. I'm sure they didn't dare act this way in Darwin's time. How can I make them stop? Disgusted in the Galapagos. Now, I suppose masturbating serves some purpose, at least as far as iguanas go. What would that be?
Well, the iguana story is very curious. It turns out that these marine iguanas, which live in the Galapagos, have a problem. Young males have a problem, which is that females whether they prefer to mate with big males or not, usually do mate with big males because the big males are able to push the little males off. And so you don't have much time if you're a young male iguana. And it turns out that a little bit of masturbation to get yourself ready for sex decreases the length of time you need to complete copulation before. So this reduces the chance that you will be interrupted. As far as I know, no other species masturbates in order to reduce the chance of being interrupted.
Now, one theme of your book is the collision of the sexes, which, being so intense in so many species, sometimes generates horrific outcomes, such as rape and cannibalism. And I do like how your first chapter in this category starts, rule number one, never get eaten during foreplay. what evolutionary purpose does the violence in sex, then, among many species serve?
Well, cannibalism is a particularly curious example. Everybody knows that the praying mantis has a tendency to munch on her lover. But what everybody doesn't know is that quite often this happens even before he's had a chance to mate. From his point of view, this is a fiasco. Obviously, if he's dead, he cannot pass on any genes. And it's not just the praying mantis who is guilty of this. It's been reported in cannibalism of this kind, has been reported in spiders, more than 80 species. It's also been reported particularly graphically in the in some predaceous midges, where the female plunges her proboscis into the male's head and her spittle turns his innards to soup. So from the male's point of view, this is being cannibalized is incredibly bad news, particularly if it happens before sex. If it happens during sex, he may still have a chance. He may be able to fertilize some eggs. And if it happens after sex, it may also not be too bad. It depends on his particular situation. For example, the Australian redback spider is the only known species where the male actually would like to be cannibalized, and he jumps into the female's jaws and attempts to persuade her to eat him. All the while she is eating, he is copulating, because in spiders the male's genitalia are modified mouthparts, and so she munches on his belly and he reaches under and fits his mouthparts into the appropriate places on her belly. But this is very unusual, and it turns out that the reason that he doesn't mind being cannibalized, in fact, invites it, is that males who are being eaten are allowed to copulate for longer, and therefore they fertilize a higher proportion of eggs. Males who are rejected will be rejected very quickly, and therefore will not actually be able to fertilize many eggs at all. But for most males, they do not wish to be eaten because being eaten, first of all, precludes reproducing with a given female, and it also obviously precludes reproducing again. But from the female's point of view, it may not necessarily be that bad. At first glance, it appears that for a female to eat a male before sex is idiotic. But in fact, if a female is likely to meet many males during the course of her life, as indeed in many spiders she will do, then it doesn't matter if she eats most of them. As long as she doesn't remain a virgin, she's okay. And so sometimes it's not going to be too bad, and it may even occasionally be to her advantage.
Now here's a provocative quote from your book. True monogamy is one of the most deviant behaviors in biology. So how rare is rare?
It seems to be pretty rare. I combed the literature for examples, proven examples of monogamy, and they are very, very scarce. And I think that the reason is that it's rarely in anybody's advantage to be monogamous, if you are discussing monogamy purely in terms of how many offspring you'll produce, which is how success is measured in evolutionary terms. Monogamy is rarely advantageous for either sex, and so the conditions under which it evolves are peculiar and unusual.
There are some species, though, that do mate for life. You cite vultures.
The black vulture is one of my favorite examples. The black vulture does appear, as far as we know at the moment, it does appear to be monogamous. They have an interesting social system. They nest in pairs and on territories, quite large territories. But it's not simply a lack of opportunity thing, because vultures, black vultures, are dependent on carcasses, and many vultures will convene at a single carcass. And so there are certainly opportunities for meeting other vultures and having a bit on the side. But it turns out that the black vultures are, well, prudish. They don't like to see sexual behavior in public. And if an inexperienced black vulture attempts to seduce somebody in public, everybody will attack him or her. And so this appears to reinforce the tendency for monogamous behavior. But there are other species that seem to be monogamous. My guess is that many species of shrimp may turn out to be monogamous. There are certainly quite a few that live in stable pairs, but shrimp are less studied than birds, and so we don't know nearly so much about them.
Can we talk about homosexuality then? If a majority of species do break down to male and female, what does evolutionary biology, how does it inform us on the question of human sexuality and homosexuality among our species?
Well, it's often said, particularly among social conservatives, for example, that homosexuality is unnatural, that it occurs only in humans, and it is some weird deviant behavior. There are two things that I'd like to say about that. The first is that whether it's natural or not is irrelevant, because I could find examples of all sorts of behavior that people would find abhorrent. For example, incest is very common in many organisms, but humans believe that close brother-sister incest is a bad idea. So whether it is natural or not is irrelevant. However, it turns out that, in fact, homosexual behavior is very common in the animal world, much more common than people have thought. And the range is extraordinary. The reason that many people assume that homosexuality cannot be something that occurs in nature is because homosexuals, particularly in the West now, homosexuals tend not to have children, and therefore any genes for homosexuality should disappear very quickly. Well, in other organisms, we know almost nothing about the extent to which homosexual behavior is exclusive. Many individuals engage in bisexual behavior, but I would, for the sake of argument, you can say, well, if the behavior is exclusive, so homosexuals never reproduce, and it is fairly common, so you can't just dismiss it as a fluke, then is there any way that the genes could be maintained in the population? And I think that there are ways that they can be maintained. For example, if a gene that leads to homosexuality in one sex leads to very great reproductive success in the other, then you would expect to see a certain proportion of individuals who are homosexual throughout their lives.
Well, one of the standard arguments against human homosexuality, at least a biological one, runs that if it doesn't lead to reproduction, how can it be a genetic trait? But in this case, it leads to reproduction of others. Lending a helping hand.
Not necessarily lending a helping hand. It may be that the gene itself is just very beneficial when it is manifested in one sex. It's certainly true that genes are expressed differently in the different sexes very often, and in that case, you might expect to see that there are some genes that produce homosexuality in one sex, but produce some very beneficial trait in the other, a trait that leads to much greater reproductive success, either very great fecundity or very good looks. This is speculation. We don't know for sure, but that would be one mechanism by which genes for exclusive homosexuality could be maintained.
Well, I have to say, a lot of the information in the book makes human sex quite pallid in comparison. Did you come away with your own conclusions about deviancy or any species you particularly envy?
Well, it certainly broadened my horizons. I think that I would like to be reincarnated as a number of species. I think, for example, it would be fascinating to be a dolphin. For all sorts of reasons, but particularly because they seem to have such amazing sex drive. I think that would be fascinating. But I think that in general, I mean, human sex may be dull, and in many respects it is, but basically I'm pretty glad to be human.
Olivia Judson, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Olivia Judson's book is Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation. This is Fresh Air.